Good evening. I am Brett Wigdortz, Program Associate for Southeast Asia, and I would like to welcome you to the Asia Society tonight. Nick Platt, President of the Asia Society, wanted very much to be here tonight. Unfortunately, he is traveling in Japan and unable to join us. Tonight, we have the privilege of launching a book that examines the Vietnam conflict from new angles. This program is part of our ongoing policy program series presented by our Policy and Business Division. Our goal is to increase American awareness of key issues in Asian affairs and to broaden the dialogue between Americans and Asians. In our Education Division, the Society sponsors an ongoing internet-based program on Vietnam for students and teachers. To learn more about this initiative, be sure to pick up a Vietnam Challenge poster in the lobby outside or visit the website www.askasia.org. We would also like to thank the publisher of this provocative book, Public Affairs, for their support and cooperation tonight. After tonight's program, I would like to invite all of you to a reception outside the auditorium where this book, Argument Without End, will be available for purchase, and the authors will be there to sign the book. Now, without further ado, I'm delighted to introduce our moderator for tonight's program, Dr. Marilyn Young. Dr. Young is a professor of history at NYU. She has authored and edited numerous books and articles on the Vietnam War, including The Vietnam Wars, 1945 to 1990, Vietnam, A Documented History, and Vietnam War in American Memory. Please join me in welcoming Dr. Young and our distinguished panelists here tonight.
Good evening. I shall introduce each speaker in turn. They will speak for approximately 15 minutes, at the end of which time there will be a good half hour for questions. We'll begin with Robert S. McNamara, who served as, some of you may remember, Secretary of Defense from 1961 to 1968 under Presidents Kennedy and Johnson. McNamara came to the Department of Defense from his post as president of the Ford Motor Company in Detroit. He played, as you know, critical roles in all of the major foreign policy crises, successes and near misses in the Kennedy period and the early Johnson period. He is the author of a remarkable book some of you may have read, In Retrospect, The Tragedy and Lessons of Vietnam, published in 1995. In that book, he describes the evolution of his views on the Vietnam War, a process that in that same year brought him to Hanoi and the beginning of a series of conferences which has yielded the book now published, Argument Without End. Mr. Secretary, if you would take your 15 minutes.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Dr. Young. Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Another book on Vietnam. For God's sake, why another book? Well, let me first try to tell you why. In the preface to the book that Dr. Young referred to, In Retrospect, I said this is the book I plan never to write. I finally decided to write In Retrospect because I thought it was necessary to put before the American people why their government behaved as it did with respect to Vietnam and what lessons might be drawn from that experience. The publication of the book stimulated immense interest. About 450,000 copies were sold. And if you're ever tempted to read it, be sure to buy the paperback edition for several reasons. A, it costs less. But B, more importantly, there's not a word in the text changed except for one sentence, which says that General Giap told me in the course of preparing for this new book that the so-called second Tonkin Gulf attack, which led to the Tonkin Gulf resolution that was the foundation of the authority for all of the actions taken by the Johnson administration after that, the second Tonkin Gulf attack had never occurred. Apart from that one sentence, there's not a word change in the text, but There's a 120-page appendix to that book that outlines and quotes the media reaction to the book, and it ranged from very, very harsh criticism to warm praise. And you have to, if you're going to read the book, you have to read that appendix to really understand how then, and to some degree today, our people have yet to come to grips with Vietnam. And in a sense, that's one reason I wrote this book. But another reason, more compelling, is that at the end of writing In Retrospect, an hypothesis formed in my mind. Now, before I tell you the nature of the hypothesis, I should tell you that from the point of view of the Vietnamese, North and South, the Vietnam War was one of the bloodiest wars in all of human history. They say, Hanoi says, that they lost 3,800,000 people killed, North and South, military, civilian. On a U.S. population base, that's equivalent to 27 million American dead. And I mention the 27 million to try to give you an impression of what this war meant to the Vietnamese. Think how we would feel if we'd lost 27 million dead. It was tragic as it was for us. We lost 58,000 dead. But in any event, from their point of view, it was one of the bloodiest wars in all of human history. And the hypothesis that was forming in my mind was this. I believed there was reason to think each of us, they, the North Vietnamese, and we, the U.S., could either have avoided the war entirely or terminated it on any one of a number of occasions with tremendous savings and lives lost, without the terrible disruption to each of our societies, and without any change in our ending geopolitical position. That was my hypothesis. And it was based on an analysis of what I called missed opportunities, opportunities to have stopped the war, prevented the war, a whole series of them. And the point I was concerned about was, were these really missed opportunities? If they were, why were they missed? What lessons could one draw from that? I felt there was no way I could write that examination of the hypothesis without engaging in dialogue with the North Vietnamese, those individuals living today, or then, this was in 1995, say roughly 4 years ago, individuals living then in Hanoi who had had positions of leadership, military, diplomatic, or political, in the 1960s, and who I visualized would meet with their counterparts, U.S. counterparts, plus scholars from each side, to examine this hypothesis, go over each of the missed opportunities that I was pointing to, and draw conclusions. Were they true opportunities? Were they missed? Why were they missed? What lessons? And I thought, how can we arrange to stimulate these dialogues? And I thought of calling on a reputable organization. At that time, as you would perhaps recall, in 1995, we had no diplomatic relations with Vietnam. And I thought, how can we arrange the initial contact for an ex-secretary, a person they consider partially responsible for these 3,800,000 dead? They were not likely to readily accept my proposal that we meet together to engage in an examination of errors each of us have made. So I thought of calling on Les Gelb, the president then and president today of the Council on Foreign Relations. Les had worked with me in the Defense Department. It was he I put in charge of what I called the Pentagon Papers Project. He did a superb job on that. So I asked Les to contact them. He said, no way, Bob. They're not going to respond. What you're asking them to do is admit that they made errors, and they're not going to do that. I said, look, Les, at least propose it to them and see what they say. So he did. He contacted their then ambassador to the UN, Le Van Bang, and he said exactly what Les had said. Well, the Politburo, who was then in control of the government as it is today, will definitely not accept this because the Politburo is not about to admit that they made mistakes that resulted in the deaths of some millions of Vietnamese. But he said, I'll take it to them anyhow. They'll say no, but I'll take it to them. He did. They came back and said, I had asked that we have a a reconnaissance mission of three or four scholars, U.S. scholars, go over and meet with theirs and see if we could arrange a program to examine my hypothesis. They came back, oddly enough, and said, yes, we'll accept the scholars, but the condition was McNamara would have to come to him. So I did. And that's how it began. And from that beginning came seven meetings with the Vietnamese in Hanoi, six in Hanoi and one in Bellagio. The Rockefeller Foundation financed a meeting of international specialists on Vietnam and on war to review the first manuscript of the book, Argument Without End, in Bellagio at the Rockefeller Conference Center. It was a tremendous help to us in preparing the book. In any event, we went to Hanoi. We had seven meetings with them. One lasted 4 days. And we went over these hypotheses. The cover of the book, which you can't see, but it shows two human beings. One, this side, is the then foreign minister of the 1960s and later, Foreign Minister Tok. And the other side is me. And Tok's fist is in my face because on the first day when I presented my hypothesis, he said, nobody made any mistakes. You're absolutely right. There were missed opportunities. The war could have been prevented. It could have been stopped. But the only people that missed opportunities were you people. We didn't do anything wrong. It was all your fault. And he shoved his fist in my face, and he was on the verge of hitting me. Now, that's how it began. It ended about 4 days later. When he said, Bob, I was wrong. We made mistakes. We killed hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of people unnecessarily. Each of us are responsible for that. We must learn how to avoid it. Thank God he said it, because he died about 3 months later. He was unable to participate in the remaining meetings. Now, the book is structured around this hypothesis, or these so-called missed opportunities. There's a chapter on each. By the way, one of the potential missed opportunities, and this is conventional wisdom in our country today, and it's very important that one recognize this as conventional wisdom, and recognize it, at least in my view, and the view of the book, it was not a missed opportunity. The conventional wisdom is we could have won militarily. We constrained our military. That's why we lost. Chapter 7 of the book, which does not include a word written by me except the introduction, is written by an outstanding military authority, Colonel Chandler, who spent two tours in Vietnam as an infantry commander, graduate of West Point, two tours in Vietnam, Harvard PhD, author of many articles and books on Vietnam. He's been a professor for years of military strategy at the National Defense University. He's the author of Chapter 7. If you're interested in this thesis, could we have won? And it's important to think about that because it relates to Kosovo today. If you're interested in that thesis, read Chapter 7. He says categorically, there was absolutely no way ever, from the time Kennedy came in January 61 until the time we removed American forces in 1972 and 73, there was no way whatsoever we could have won, short of committing genocide or engaging in the risk of large-scale war with China and Russia, which the President and I were totally opposed to. In any event, the book is structured around the hypothesis, examines the missed opportunities, and the last chapter is entitled Lessons, because the purpose of the book is to try to draw lessons. Now, before, and we'll talk some about that, I'm sure, in the question-answer period, but before I turn the podium over to Professor Jim Blight of Brown University, I want to say one last word. You may find this very hard to believe, but I want to tell you of my earliest memory as a child. It's of a city exploding with joy. I was born in San Francisco. The city was San Francisco. The date was November 11, 1918, Armistice Day. I was 2 years old. The city, of course, was celebrating the end of World War I, but it was also celebrating the view of many in the city, many Americans, and certainly of President Wilson, that we'd won a war to end all wars. How wrong we were. This century is the bloodiest century in all of human history. 160 million human beings will have been killed by conflict, conflict within nations and conflict extending across borders. Is that what you want for the 21st century, the first century in the new millennium? It's not what I want. I doubt that it's what you want. If we don't want it, how to avoid it? One step toward avoiding it is to understand better than most of us do how we found ourselves involved in this terrible carnage of this century. Vietnam was an element of that. The purpose of the book is to help avoid a repetition of that. And I hope it contributes to that end. Thank you very much.
I wonder if we could have the house lights up. This is a very odd effect. We are bathed in light. Thank you. We can't see you at all. And I feel much easier looking at people when I'm talking. The next speaker is Professor James Blight. Jim is a professor of international relations, connected with the Thomas J. Watson Institute for International Studies at Brown University. He is a cognitive psychologist by training, I actually didn't know that, who, along with Joseph S. Nye, was the founder and director of the Missile Crisis Project at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government and at Brown's Watson Institute. He is the author or co-author of 6 books on the Cuban Missile Crisis, the most recent being Politics of Illusion, The Bay of Pigs Invasion Reexamined, which he wrote with Peter Kornbluh. Jim has been central to the Vietnam War Project, and he'll tell you something about the project and the methodology that is used in the book. Jim.
Thank you, Marilyn. Of the 4 people you're looking at, the current speaker is best described as the resident dilettante, or methodologist is the way I put it on my job resume. I'm not a specialist on Vietnam, and what I'd like to do is to explain a little bit about how this process that produced these dialogues, these extraordinary conversations between Bob McNamara, some of his former colleagues, and then some of their former adversaries. But first I want to say that we did the first of these book events at Brown 2 days after National Secretary's Day, and we thought it'd be appropriate if the secretary went first, and he's gone first ever since. We can't talk him out of it. The British historian and philosopher R.G. Collingwood once wrote, "In history, as in all serious matters, no achievement is ever final. Every new generation must rewrite history in its own way. Every new historian, not content with giving answers to old questions, must revise the questions themselves." Bob Brigham, to my left, and I find it ironical that the research team leading the way in this rewriting of the history of the Vietnam War is headed by a man who is neither a professional historian nor, at 82 years of age, soon to be 83, is a member of anybody's new generation. Yet our book, Argument Without End, which was has been four years, almost to the day, in the making, we believe is a work of serious history, one that's different in many respects, or at least some important respects, from what has come before it. Why? Because in our efforts to keep pace with our senior author, to my immediate right, we've asked questions that seldom, if ever, have been asked in the West. We've asked them of knowledgeable Vietnamese scholars and former officials who've never before spoken for the public record, and because their answers over the last 4 years have been given within the context of an evolving U.S.-Vietnamese dialogue of increasing trust and openness. How did it happen? It began, from my point of view, at 7 a.m. on a Saturday morning in February of 1995, when Bob McNamara called out of the blue, just before, in retrospect, his memoir of the war was published. He presented a proposition. He asked 2 questions, as he would say. Number 1, First, whether I thought it might be possible to create a project on the Vietnam War on the model of the Cuban Missile Crisis Project, on which we had collaborated together from 1987 through 1992, and which culminated in a conference, a four-day conference in Havana, Cuba, at which Bob led our delegation and which Fidel Castro led from the Cuban side. If so, if it could be organized, would I be willing to organize it? I told him with profound honesty that I had no clue whether such a thing were possible, but if it were possible, I would give it a shot. So I called Bob Brigham. Actually, I made four or five phone calls, and they all resulted in the advice, call Bob Brigham. Why? Bob Brigham reads and speaks Vietnamese. He's lived in Vietnam. He was one of the first Americans ever to use the archives in Vietnam on the war. And yet, he studied with George Herring at the University of Kentucky, who is our most prolific scholar of American decision-making. And in short, was a person who could keep all of us honest. I called Bob and asked him if he'd think about participating, and he took about as long to decide as I did. He said, of course. I would like to insert here a little scuttlebutt from the authors, sort of behind the scenes. It has been virtually impossible to keep these Bobs straight in our memos and so forth. And Jim Hirschberg, one of our colleagues now at George Washington University, suggested a grand bargain. This Bob is Maximum Bob, after the lead character in an Elmore Leonard novel about a Florida hanging judge who hangs people from everything from parking tickets to multiple murder. And seldom has a collaborator been so aptly nicknamed. This is Historical Bob. For obvious reasons, but it's gotten a little confusing because the executive officer works for Peter Osnos and now refers to this Bob, Maximum Bob, as Historic Bob, which, of course, is an accurate statement, but on telephones, voicemails, and so forth, much confusion has resulted. But I can tell you the two Bobs are what have made this project possible. I told Maximum Bob McNamara, sure, we would do this. We had no funding. Funding would be a real issue in this project. No contacts with the Vietnamese, no committed American participants other than Bob McNamara, no understanding, at least on my part, of the details of the sensitive political factors in Washington and Hanoi that would affect our historical investigation. And remember, February of 1995 is before Bob's book was published. And at least I was surprised at the vehemence, at the virtual earthquake that occurred when his memoir came out. I was present in one evening in Cambridge, Massachusetts, where I then lived, and saw people destroy his books on Cambridge Common, who came from this side of the spectrum, and in front of Draper Labs down in Kendall Square, who came from that side of the spectrum. I hadn't seen anything like that in 30 years. The Missile Crisis Project was the experience that Bob McNamara and I shared. And let me just say about that the reason it became critical to sort of bucking up our courage to try this, not in a project where one person died, a pilot shot down over Cuba, but as Bob said, somewhere between 3 and 4 million people died, bound to be more difficult to discuss objectively, was that we discovered in the Missile Crisis Project that you can learn things that you never knew before, that you never thought of before, and in fact were absolutely unimaginable before. One example, some of you may know about it, is that there were 162 fully armed nuclear warheads on the northern shore of Cuba by the last weekend in October 1962, that the standing orders to the field commander were to use them. The orders had been revoked at the last minute. The commander chose to ignore them, and that if Bob McNamara and President Kennedy and the others had seen fit or had not been able to avoid sending in the Marines, they would have all been incinerated in the first nuclear war that this country had ever participated in as a victim. And the response to that would have been more of the same. Nobody imagined that these weapons were on the island, much less that the instructions were to use. It was that kind of experience that made us wonder what would happen if we tested Bob's hypothesis about missed opportunities. What would happen if we took the scholars and the documents and the decision makers who had the responsibility on their shoulders and stirred it up like a soup and just see what happened? One comment, and then I want to conclude. Those of us who never bore this kind of responsibility have to step back in awe, not just of Bob, but of all the people on all sides who chose to participate in this project. They are responsible, to an extent, for the tragedy that occurred. That's the problem we chose to attack, which was how could something happen which turned out to be an unmitigated disaster for everybody? Nobody wanted it. Nobody foresaw exactly what happened. So how did it come about? And I can tell you that the first day's discussions were every bit as brutal and as accusatory as you can imagine. We broke several times to decide whether to walk out of the conference and go home. I know there were conversations on the other side that were much like that. Now, Mr. Nwinko Tok, who here has his fist in Bob's face at the first lunch, however, chose to end his participation in the conference by taking an anti-American speech, a virulent speech, the contents of which have become known to us since, put it back in his briefcase and say, I'm not going to make this speech. Let's continue the dialogue. And please, I mean not just today, but I mean in the future. And as Bob said, he died several months after that. Six dialogues have occurred in the meanwhile. Joseph Lelieveld of the New York Times once wrote, when we talk about Vietnam, we are seldom talking about the country of that name or the situation of the people who live there. Usually we are talking about ourselves. Probably we always were. My co-authors, Bob McNamara, Bob Brigham, Tom Bierstecker from Brown, and Colonel Herb Chandler from the National Defense University, hope that argument without end signals the beginning of the end of what seems to me to have been a narcissistic American obsession with what the war has done to us, and the beginning of our understanding of the multi-sidedness of it, of the interactive nature of the decisions made in Washington and Hanoi and elsewhere. Because of this book, when we talk about Vietnam, quote unquote, we hope that henceforth we will be talking about a tragedy brought on by the mutual colossal ignorance of Americans and Vietnamese communists, both North and South. For the first time, we hope, and I think believe, that we have enough facts about decision-making on both sides to move beyond blaming to real understanding. Thank you.
The final speaker is Robert Brigham, Associate Professor of History and Director of the Program in International Relations at Vassar College. He is also a tour leader extraordinaire, and should you have the opportunity to join one of the tours he regularly leads to Vietnam, run through Vassar College, I strongly urge it. Professor Brigham was trained, as Jim Blight mentioned, by George Herring, perhaps the preeminent historian of the Vietnam War, at the University of Kentucky. He studied as well under a number of experts at Cornell University. He has published widely on the war in both English and Vietnamese language journals. His most recent book, just out, and I strongly urge purchase, is Guerrilla Diplomacy, the NLF's Foreign Relations and the Vietnam War, one of the first books, I think really the first book, that uses archives from both the South and the North and explores the NLF and its position and the tensions between the NLF and Hanoi. He is currently writing an essay for a book I am editing, this is just to remind him, and a book on the South Vietnamese Army. And he will address the subject of what new information has emerged from this series of meetings that Mr. Secretary and Jim Blight have described.
Thank you, Marilyn. Marilyn and I are good friends, and I've told this story on her before, and I hope she doesn't mind. I do it again. The first paper I ever presented in public, I had a scholarly conference. Marilyn was the commenter on it. And her kind words encouraged me to continue in the direction I was going, which was to look at Vietnamese sources on the American War. And I'm really delighted to be here with you tonight, Marilyn. When Jim Blake called and asked me if I would participate in this Critical Oral History Conference, I did take a nanosecond to say yes, primarily because I'd known Jim's work in the Cuban Missile Crisis, respected the methodology, respected him greatly, and when he said that Bob McNamara was involved, this is just as In Retrospect was coming out, and I had read it. I thought it was the most courageous publication by a formal official I'd ever read, and so I jumped at the chance to do this, and I haven't been sorry for that 1 minute of the last 4 years. What I'm going to do tonight for you now is to give you three examples of some things we've learned from this process and this project. The book is over 400 pages long, and in every chapter there are new things. It's like an onion that we slowly peel, and we discover new historical revelations, but I'll just share with you three. They are two from 1965, the attack on Pleiku and December 1965 bombing pause, and then the peace initiative codenamed Pennsylvania. I think these three are representative of what we're trying to do in this book. They show, I think, in very clear detail, opportunities that were missed by both sides to open the communication, to end the war sooner, and I think all three of these are not counterfactual history, but they're real opportunities that we should have grasped in real time. And we can use them to draw lessons in the future so that we don't face these same kind of problems. As all of you know, or most of you probably know, in February 1965, communist forces attacked a U.S. Army barracks at Pleiku. And then a few days later, they attacked again at Quy Nhon. The attacks came when McGeorge Bundy, the National Security Advisor, was in Saigon, and the Soviet Foreign Minister Kosygin was in Hanoi. Bundy went up from Saigon to Pleiku, which is in the Central Highlands, examined the damage, reviewed the 8 dead American bodies, and took a flight home. And on the way home, he and his CIA chief operative, a man named Chester Cooper, who participated in this project and has made several trips with us to Hanoi, fired off a cable to Lyndon Johnson that became a very important cable. It said, primarily, "I've seen this damage and we must retaliate. If we wait, these events will increase in frequency." Within weeks, Johnson approved the sustained bombing of North Vietnam that we now call Operation Rolling Thunder. For a long time, historians have seen Pleiku as the trigger. This was what got Americans into the war. It is the attack at Pleiku that leads to the air war, and it is defense of air bases that brings the first American ground troops. The first Marines that land on March 8th in 1965 in Da Nang are not there on offensive mission, necessarily. They're there to protect American air bases. Their mission changes in July 1965. So this Pleiku event is pivotal in the escalation of the war. What we've found out in our dialogues has been most fascinating. One, Hanoi had absolutely no role in the command and control of the attack on Pleiku. It was part of the regular People's War activity carried out primarily by southern irregular guerrillas, not even irregular guerrilla forces, but irregular guerrillas, who had absolutely no idea that there were Americans in this army installation. Before American ground troops came to Vietnam, American soldiers there were in an advisory capacity. And these Americans were attached to an Arvin infantry unit. The barracks was clearly marked, the Vietnamese say in the day, by Arvin insignia. It was a nighttime attack. It was with long-range mortars. They had no idea that Americans were in what they perceived as a South Vietnamese army installation. And it was locally controlled. Furthermore, Vietnamese communists who led the attack had no idea whatsoever that Bundy was in Saigon or that Kosygin was in Hanoi. So from Washington's perspective, this seemed like a purposeful act by Hanoi to escalate the conflict, but it wasn't that at all. Even more important, I think, when we place the attack on Pleiku in historical context, it really looms large in the history of escalation. A few weeks before the attack on Pleiku, Bob McNamara and McGeorge Bundy sent to Johnson what became known as the Fork in the Road memo. That memo basically said, the present course we're on is not going to get us anywhere in Vietnam. We need to do one of two things. We either need to step up our presence in Vietnam, or we need to withdraw. whatever we decide, we must fully debate this. We must open this up for a cabinet-level debate. Play coup killed that debate. It never took place. Because just as the forces would be gathering to discuss this, in comes Bundy, fresh from the field, with his provocative attack by the communists. So that clearly was a missed opportunity. Chet Cooper, who was with Bundy in this, in the investigation of Play Coup in 1965, was also with us in Hanoi in 1997 and again in 1998. When he heard these revelations, said, without a doubt, that if Bundy knew this was part of the regular People's War activity, that it was not a purposeful, provocative action by Hanoi, he probably would have written a very different memo. And what would have that done to the climate inside the Johnson White House? We can wonder, we can speculate, I think, maybe a different outcome, at least for the air war. The next event in 1965 I want to talk to you about took place in December. And this is where the synchronicity of history is a fascinating and tragic thing. In December 1965, many of you will know that Bob McNamara went down to the Johnson Ranch in Texas and convinced Johnson, through probably a lot of hard work, convinced Johnson to a bombing pause. He said that, you know, we had introduced large number of ground troops in July and that we really still hadn't figured out what Hanoi's 4 points were that they came out with in April, and that we needed to probe Hanoi to see what was going on there. And he got a 37-day bombing pause. The bombing pause did not bear fruit, however, and we've often wondered why. Why didn't this long, sustained pause have better outcome diplomatically? We now know that as the White House was debating the efficacy of a bombing pause, in Hanoi they were holding their annual party plenum. Each year, Hanoi held the Communist Party held a party plenum in the last quarter of the year. In December 1965, for 7 days, the Communist Party gathered to decide, from their perspective, what to do about the war, too. They had miscalculated completely the Americans' willingness to go it alone in Vietnam. They had miscalculated completely the Johnson administration's escalation in July 1965. There were several southern communists who were pushing the party very hard to spend all of its resources on a battlefield victory in the south. Nguyen Chi Tan, who was the director of the party's southern directorate, known as COSVIN, was a staunch advocate for kind of a Clausewitzian view of the battlefield. He saw big units and big warfare, and he thought that Americans' escalation was gradual enough that if the party threw everything behind the war in the South, they could win, in his words, in a relatively short period of time. Well, opposing that view were Northerners who said, your action in the South, your provocative action, your ideas of a full-scale war in the South are causing us severe damage. We are being bombed in the North for your actions in the South. So there are a group of northern communist officials who dominate the National Assembly who really want to seek out, in this 37-day pause, seek out Americans to try to limit the war through negotiations to south of the 17th parallel. The irony here is tragic and tremendous. Both sides eventually in the same year, at the same time, commit themselves to a protracted war, to a strategy of attrition. And neither side knew the other was doing this. Now, in a sense of grand strategy, this does not have to be a surprise. Right? The Tet Offensive, there is some strategic interest in having surprise. But when both military move to a protracted war, the element of surprise is not as important as it is knowing what the other side is doing. There is no face-to-face consultation between Hanoi and Washington from 1961 until 1968. At the highest levels of government. This would have been an ideal time as both governments are struggling with what to do and that they're both coming up with the same solution. We protract the war and we try to wait the other side out. We use negotiations. We increase as gradually as we can. This would have been a wonderful time in those 37 days to have a probe at the highest levels. But as Bob McNamara said repeatedly, there wasn't 7 minutes of conversation at the highest levels. This is a great missed opportunity. I think December 1965 is perhaps one of the greatest missed opportunities to have a meaningful diplomatic initiative. The last great initiative opportunity, I think, came in the late summer and early fall of 1967, and it's called Pennsylvania. Now, this is an initiative that the State Department had kicked around for a while, and it didn't go anywhere. And it finally ended up with Bob McNamara, who contacted two French scientists who had a connection to Ho Chi Minh. One of them, Ho Chi Minh, was his daughter's godfather. So the two French scientists went with the latest American position on bombing and infiltration, went to Hanoi, spoke with the foreign ministry. And the foreign ministry in Hanoi, unlike our side, you know, the fact that a secretary of defense is initiating a peace initiative will tell you that there's a systemic problem on our side. Our secret peace initiatives were not carefully coordinated. But in Hanoi, the foreign ministry had a chart, and there was a tripwire. And they charted each initiative, and they'd see a little bit of movement, a little bit of movement. Well, when they got to Pennsylvania, when Pennsylvania came, they saw this as something they could work with. They saw this as something that they could sit across the table from an American at a high level and negotiate a peace. In fact, it's Pennsylvania that does provide the framework for the October 1972 peace draft that's initialed by Le Ducteur and Henry Kissinger that eventually is signed after the Christmas bombings in January 73. So this really did contain something different. Then why didn't it end the war? If the foreign ministry in Vietnam is committed to it, and Johnson appears to be committed to this, why doesn't it end the war? Well, there are several reasons. Let me concentrate on the Vietnamese side. Many American writers have talked about the American side of this, but let me tell you from the Vietnamese side why we think this doesn't happen. Within the Political Bureau, which is a 12-person organization that's responsible for most policy making in Hanoi, there sits a military commission made up of seven people. The military commission had thought that these foreign ministry types had sold them out at Geneva, that they had lost at the diplomatic table, what the military had won on the field, and they were never going to let that happen again. And they thought as the war dragged on, and they kept wanting to initiate these secret peace initiatives, that it was going to be more of the same. So the military commission, beginning in April 1967, had started planning the Tet Offensive. And when the Pennsylvania initiative came through the foreign ministry, came into a Political Bureau discussion, the military commission killed it right there. They said, no, we're not going to let you go forward with this. The Tet Offensive is our plan to push Americans to the bargaining table through a battlefield defeat, and that's what's going to happen. And unfortunately for both sides, that's not what's going to happen. More Americans die after peace talks open in Paris in May 1968 than before. Two-thirds of all Vietnamese casualties come after peace talks open, after this failed initiative. So in our discussions with the Vietnamese, we think that this is clearly a missed opportunity, that both sides, if they'd had communication at the highest level earlier, perhaps this initiative could have done what it actually does do in 1972, end the war. Thank you.
We'll have a half an hour for questions, and I'd like to ask you to state your name, your affiliation, if that's relevant, and to indicate to whom your question is addressed. And I use the word question. There's no limit as to subject matter, but there is as to form. If you're not clever enough to make your speech into a question, don't. So if you could please ask questions. I'll field them. I think, are there microphones? Yes, there are. First arm that went up was over here, and it's actually someone I recognize. Yeah.
Marilyn, I'm not going to speak it to you, but I'd like to address you to Secretary McNamara.
Do you want to say who you are?
Yeah, Martin Rivlin, Columbia. I would like to address this to Secretary McNamara. I mean, there were people in the administration who had grave doubts at mid-level and so on. I mean, Bernard Fall and others, and I simply don't understand why some of these weren't acted on. And to Dr. Brigham, I'm also curious about your comment about the military having felt that the foreign ministry sold them out. Because my impression, if I remember, is that Ho Chi Minh thought that Zhou Enlai and the Russians putting pressure on Zhou Enlai at Geneva sold them out, because despite what Dulles did, that, you know, it was the Chinese and the Russians.
With response to the first question, I'm sure there were some people in the administration, probably as early as January 61, who had doubts about the thesis that Eisenhower had put forward in 1954, that in Eisenhower's words, the dominoes, meaning the independent nations of East and South Asia, would fall to communism if South Vietnam was controlled by Chinese and or Soviet communists. But that was not the view of the majority of Asian experts in the administration. Moreover, and this is a very important point, there were no